Welcome to this month's City Talks, where we'll be looking at inequality in cities. Urbanists like to describe cities as places of upward social mobility, places where people can improve their lives and develop great careers. The promise of higher wages and a wider variety of job opportunities is a powerful draw for people to live and work in cities. Indeed, the huge migration from rural to urban areas is the major trend driving urbanisation in developing countries around the world. But no matter how quickly cities raise living standards, some new arrivals and those already living there will fall through the cracks. And those that are successful nevertheless have to share the city with people still trying to make their way, or indeed trying to make ends meet. So are cities inevitably places of inequality? Does this matter? And assuming it does, can we and should we reduce it? And should we worry about the mix of rich and poor inhabitants within cities? Joining me to discuss these questions, I have Laura Gardner, Senior Analyst at the Resolution Foundation, and Professor Fran Tonkis, Director of Cities Programme at the London School of Economics. Laura, if I can turn to you first, we're talking about inequality and how it plays out in cities, but before we get into the detail, just unpack this term inequality. What are we talking about and what are the national trends?
Well, when people talk about inequality, they can mean an awful lot of things, opportunities and services, but in general, in the kind of policy space, we tend to be talking about incomes, household incomes. So what drives those incomes? Well, one of the main things is the wages that people take out of the labour market. Other things drive incomes too, and therefore overall inequality, the role of the tax and benefit system, and also crucially, housing costs, because we often like to define incomes after people have paid for housing, because that's a pretty basic need for most households. So when you add together the role of wages and the mix of adults in employment in a household, the role of taxes, the role of welfare for those in and out of work, and the impact of the housing market on people's disposable incomes, that's when you get a picture of inequality. The general trend in the UK has been some periods of rising inequality in the run-up to the financial crisis. That's stalled or even reversed a bit during the financial crisis. And when you compare us to other countries, tend to be a bit more unequal than a lot of Europe, a bit less unequal than places like the US.
And is that a long-standing position in that we are slightly more equal than the US and slightly less equal than Europe? Is that pretty normal, pretty long-run trend?
Yeah, I think in a lot of policy areas we tend to be somewhere in the middle, as well as geographically so, and that tends to be the case. Yeah, we're especially when you look at Scandinavian countries, which have some of the lowest levels of inequality, yeah. Some of the highest kind of redistributive approaches to reducing inequality. Mm. We tend to sit somewhere, west of that, but yeah. East of the US, if you like.
No, quite. Fran, your perspective on the big term, and it's a large term with lots of meanings to it, inequality, in addition to what Laura's just been laying out.
I'd reinforce much of what Laura said and just underline the importance of markets in producing inequalities. And Laura's touched on that in respect of labour markets, housing markets, and markets for other kinds of services. And that's one of the reasons why cities are such significant context for thinking about inequalities. The cities such as London, but many other rich world and poor world cities, increasingly are based on distribution through markets, not just in the formal economy, but also in terms of collective consumption. And some of the sort of welfare resources that Laura referred to, increasingly are organised through markets, education, health, and so on. And given the concentration and the thickness of markets in many cities, and London is exemplary of that, but it's certainly not unique, this is going to intensify the production of inequalities, because markets produce unequal outcomes. Mm. That's what they do as an effect of their functioning.
Interesting. Fran, many people observe that in the UK, like in many other countries, in fact, our cities are often more unequal than the country as a large. London is a classic, you've already raised that, but in other cities, the extremes are more stark than they are at the national level. And people see that, and then they draw the conclusion that somehow the city itself is producing that inequality and exacerbating the inequality. What's your perspective on that? Are we right to draw that conclusion? Are cities driving inequality in that way?
I think that's the right way to put it, actually. Cities as drivers of inequality rather than producing inequalities in and of themselves. Whenever you're concerned with research on cities, there's always this question: is this an urban problem, or is this just something that urban environments intensify or exacerbate? And I think that's very true of inequalities. We always have to remember that the most acute polarizations are always between urban and non-urban settlements. So at national level, people in cities tend to be richer than people outside cities. But you're right, of course, that cities tend to concentrate quite extreme inequalities within their sort of population and geographical boundaries. One of the reasons, as I've already mentioned, cities do that is because of the fact that cities are so often organised around markets. There are fewer opportunities to access services, access goods through non-market mechanisms in urban environments. Perhaps, you know, that's not so true if we're thinking of an economy like the United Kingdom's, but if we're thinking globally, there are many, many rural populations who are less reliant on markets for things like food production, for heating, for building materials and shelter and so on. So thinking globally, that kind of holds. Even so, it tends to be a trend that less dense settlements may be more reliant on various kinds of social network supports than we are in cities, where these tend to be commodified in various ways or collectively provided. But it also goes back to one of the positive aspects about cities that you mentioned at the beginning. The cities are very attractive to many different kinds of people, and they offer opportunities for people who are at the bottom of the income scale and certainly for those who are at the top. So they are attractors for very different segments of the population. Yeah. And you asked us, you know, you asked rhetorically at the start, should we worry about the mix of rich and poor in cities? We've also got to reflect on the fact that that's one of the values of urban contexts, that they do provide opportunities, spaces, livelihoods, homes for very different kinds of people, economically as well as along other vectors of difference.
Great. Well, we'll definitely come back to that. Laura, give me your perspective on, you know, the interplay between the national and the macro, as it were, and the city and the micro in terms of how inequality plays out. You know, are cities driving it, or are they just simply the recipients of forces that come from elsewhere?
There's a few factors that certainly seem to make inequality more likely within cities, and sort of more focused on the UK here. I've mentioned kind of when we're thinking about inequality in terms of incomes, a big factor in that is the labour market and what you earn in it. And in that space, I'd point to the fact that city economies are often more focused on services rather than manufacturing and production. And service industries tend to be more split between very highly skilled sectors, I'm thinking finance, consultancy, things like that, and lower skilled service jobs in retail and hospitality, for example. So you might have an industrial structure in cities that makes inequality a bit more likely in terms of what people are doing in the labour market. A couple of other factors I'd point to that certainly kind of make it unsurprising that cities tend to find greater levels of inequality. One is housing. It's really well known that we have a housing crisis in this country, and above all, what's driving that is the cost of land. Cities are dense, land is expensive. The housing crisis plays out in cities for the most part. I've talked about thinking about disposable incomes after housing costs when we measure inequality. So in areas where you have high housing costs, where the housing crisis manifests itself, that inequality point becomes more problematic. Mm. Final thing I'd say is the role of migration. Mm-hmm. Tend to get in the UK, migrants tend to be either very highly skilled, quite high earning, or low skilled. There's quite polarisation in the types of migrants you get. And migrants tend to initially at least come to cities. So if that's your inflow, if your inflow is quite unequal, then that would tend to kind of amplify inequality within cities. So kind of trends around sectors in cities, housing and what's going on with the housing crisis, and migration would all kind of come together to make it more likely that you get inequality within cities than elsewhere.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point. And, you know, a lot of the factors and issues you raise, you see them particularly in some of our very economically successful cities. You know, London is an obvious one, but there are others, Cambridge, you know, where, you know, the very success of those places seems to both attract population from both other parts of the country, but also from other parts of the world. And as you say, some of those are often at the very start of their careers or at the very start of their earning income possibilities. And so in some ways, the very attractiveness of cities, both whilst a good thing in the round, actually exacerbates the inequality because of their attractiveness to people not only at the top of the income spectrum, but actually people at the bottom. Is that what you would see and agree with, Fran? Or
I would agree, and I'd make two points there. One, to return to Laura's point about the industrial structure of cities. And again, London's a standout case, but it's not at all alone in this. The focus on service economies in many advanced cities and in many developing and emerging market cities is also seeing an exaggerated return or an exaggerated set of salary returns to people at a certain part of the service economy, and finance, real estate, these sectors exemplify this kind of trend. And we are seeing decreasing returns to skill at the bottom end of those service labour markets. So that kind of pulling apart of people who are in the same part of the economy, broadly speaking, the service sector, is one of the drivers of urban inequality. And the fact that cities do tend to concentrate these high-end services, producer services, financial services, property services, is clearly going to underpin that and reinforce that. You mentioned at the beginning, Andrew, that cities are spaces of social mobility, and I still believe that's the case. But this is downward as well as upward. Mm-hmm. And I guess another thing to mention, just to add a further nuance to the migration story, is that for many international migrants, of course, they are experiencing downward mobility as they move. And I think it's important to stress that, given the kinds of moral and political panics we're hearing about around economic migration in this country currently. For many people who are moving, especially in terms of forced migration in various forms, they're going into less skilled jobs, relatively less paid, well-paid jobs than they would have occupied. We saw it with the post-war migration from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. People who were in middle-class service capacities in their home country came to London and other UK cities and were working in lower paid and lower skilled sectors. And that's something that's often not thought about when we talk about economic migration. Mm. So that's a kind of downward mobility transnationally that appears within cities themselves simply as low paid, low skilled work.
Yeah. Laura, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, no, I just really echo the point about social mobility and the sort of should we be worrying about this? Is it inevitable kind of tenor of the questions you've been asking? I think we don't know enough about social mobility within cities and the social mobility of those who are kind of at the lower end of the wage or income distribution within cities. But we can point to some factors. So I thought I'd raise, there's some really interesting research coming out of the US by a chap called Moretti, can't remember his first name.
Enrico.
There you go. Which looks at city labour markets and asks exactly this question. And the kind of simple version of the finding is that in cities with a high concentration of innovative industries, lower skilled, lower paid people actually do better than higher skilled, highly paid people in kind of old world manufacturing cities. So that would suggest that, yes, there might be inequality within cities, but if you can get the right industrial mix and have the right set of drivers and focus on growth and innovation, you're a lot better off even being kind of at the lower end of the income distribution in one of those thriving cities than you are being anywhere else. Mm. So cities as kind of engines of growth, and I'm sceptical of the rising tide lifts all boats argument, but there does seem to be something in that. If you can get the right industrial mix within cities and create good opportunities for lower skilled, lower paid people, even with still quite high levels of inequality.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I think, as you were saying, that work does that. And then I think there's a little bit of work in the UK around, you know, the escalator effect of some of our bigger cities. You know, do we see career progression happen more quickly than we ordinarily might, given the characteristics of the individual? There does seem to be some. It certainly occurs to a degree in London. There's debates about to what extent it happens in other cities. But it begs the question then, I suppose, Fran, is we observe this issue. Should we worry about it? Should we, I mean, in the aggregate and at the individual level, should we be overly concerned with the unequal nature of many cities, not all cities, but many cities? Or do we accept that that's the trade-off for, you know, successful growing economies? You get inequality as the unwelcome side effect, but we can't really do much about it. So what's your thought on that?
Well, we get inequality in all cities, successful and less successful, and they take different kinds of forms, and we should worry about it within reason. But the worries are several. The economic worry is where patterns of inequality begin to impact on the efficiency and the dynamism of successful cities, where people can't afford to live anywhere near their places of work and waste time travelling very long distances to get to their places of employment. That's just inefficient. That's not good for an effective working economy, and it's not good for the individuals involved either. So at both the individual and the aggregate level, this is just a kind of a cost of inequality in the city, where people can't access economic opportunities because of other vectors of inequality, not just economic inequalities, but inequalities around gender in labour markets, around race and ethnicity in labour markets. That's not efficient to close off opportunities to significant segments of the population because their life chances are impacted by these kinds of divisions and discriminations. It's inefficient. It's also, we could say, unjust. So the sort of political argument is rather different from the economic argument, but they often overlap and they may well identify the same kinds of problems. Closures of opportunities, opportunity hoarding by some parts of the population, gender pay disparities around race and ethnicity, we can be critical of and worry about because we think politically it's unacceptable and socially it's exclusionary and uncohesive, but economically it's not going to maximise the efficiency and the innovative capacity of a city.
Yeah. Laura, your thought on this. I mean, inequality by nature is in part a kind of relative concept, and yet you have others that say, well, if everybody is doing better, even if some are doing better at a faster rate, we shouldn't worry so much, and the issue between is not such a concern. What's your perspective on that?
I think my perspective and perspective of the Resolution Foundation has always been you need to worry about both. It's ridiculous to think that there's a political choice between equality and growth. There is an imperative that across a range of policy areas we pursue solutions that focus on growth, so the size of the pie, and distribution or equality, how you cut the pie. And I don't think those should be mutually exclusive goals within a city or across the country. So sort of coming back to some of the arguments that we've been making, you put it exactly right, Fran, when you said we should worry about inequality within cities within reason. It's not the be-all and end-all. We don't want a perfectly equal poor city. And we also don't want a hugely successful city with basically a serfdom because of the inequality sitting below it. So that it's a balancing act, and I think looking at the strategies that make cities attractive and make them the engines of growth in our economy, while also thinking about how those opportunities and how that growth is distributed within cities and what the consequences are of too much inequality are things we should be constantly thinking about at the same time, essentially.
It's interesting. We'll get on to the what might we do about this, and you've given some hints already, but I just want to pick on something you just talked about there, Fran, a minute ago. One of the well-stated assumptions, a priorities really, is, I think you were alluding to it just now, mixed communities, mixed neighbourhoods, mixed tenures, whatever you want to call it, is a good thing and we should have more of it, and you know, where rich and poor, skilled and unskilled are rubbing shoulders with each other is a natural good and we should encourage more of it. And yet we also see strong preferences between within individuals and across groups where they wish to be sorted into to be with people like themselves or in communities that are like them. And there always seems to be this tension and issue going on between the mixing but also the sorting into similars. What's your perspective on that? Are mixed neighbourhoods inevitably a good thing? We should have more of them or not?
That's probably the most difficult question you've asked so far, Andrew. I don't have a strong moral position on mixed communities, so-called. I think mixed communities are something that cities will probably do if right. left to their own devices. I think engineering mix in neighbourhoods is very difficult to achieve. It was achieved quite successfully, I would say, through public housing programmes through to the 1980s. Our efforts to engineer mix are maybe less successful because they're less large scale currently. Some of the benefits of mixing in the cities, and I should add, I'm a sociologist and I don't think people can be forced to interact, to mix, to be convivial. I don't think this is something that politicians and policymakers or planners and designers should be overly concerned with. What they do need to be concerned with is avoiding exclusionary and segregated patterns.
So being deliberately exclusionary, even if we accept that exclusion and segregation may result from
deliberately or unintentionally,
right. Okay.
You know, the benefits of mixing, I would say, of a rich mix, as it were, in certain neighbourhoods, is precisely the point I made about opportunity earlier. People having access to urban labour markets on a relatively egalitarian basis. As Laura was saying, you don't want to have a very successful, very high-income city that's served by a kind of serfdom that lives on the periphery, for instance. So in terms of spatial access to the sorts of opportunities and resources that cities offer, mixing is beneficial at an aggregate level. I also think it's beneficial in terms of public safety, crime, and fear of crime. The more segregated a city you have, the more dangerous a city that you're going to have. More mutual distrust, you're probably going to have to police it more heavily. These are costs, both economic and socially corrosive. One of the ways in which, the primary ways in which neighbourhoods in London are being mixed currently is through processes of gentrification, where lower income neighbourhoods are seeing incoming higher income residents, transforming both the housing market and also the commercial offer and the public space of those kinds of neighbourhoods. It's almost a reversal of the mixing through building public housing. It's now mixing through privatisations of housing and the inflation of housing costs in certain neighbourhoods. Now, I don't have a strong critical position on that either, except to say that lower income neighbourhoods do provide what economists would call welfare benefits to their residents,
yes,
because they provide cheaper services,
absolutely,
they provide a cheaper consumer offer, and effects of gentrification do tend to drive out those kinds of services and resources which are provided through the private market, through lower cost shops, through particular kinds of spaces of leisure and so on. This, I think, is bad for cities, and it's certainly bad for the residents who find their neighbourhoods less and less familiar to them and less accommodating of their needs and their wallets.
Laura, your perspectives on the intrinsic value of mixing, as you know, we've been talking about, and then both as, you know, from a social perspective, I think, as well as from an economic perspective.
I think sort of echo Fran on the, I don't have a strong position on it, and I don't think it's something government can really do. I think it's something that the cities do if left to their own devices, as you said. I think economically you probably do see the value of mixing of in communities as it plays out in labour markets. So high-end services tend to kind of spring up low-end service jobs around them, and that's certainly a part of the Moretti argument that I mentioned earlier. I would just make one kind of relevant point. I said at the start that inequality, we mostly talk about incomes, and we certainly do, but there are obviously other angles. And there might be some other outcomes, I'm thinking of education now, in which cities seem to be more equal than elsewhere, and I'm really struck by the amazing record in London on school outcomes for what's called free school meals pupils, which is essentially lower
yes.
income students in London, which has been remarkable success rate in improving the educational outcomes of free school meal pupils in London. And there's probably a variety of drivers of that. There's kind of the Academies programme, the London Challenge, and a kind of concentration of Teach First within London, things like that. But whatever the drivers, London has been really, really good at creating much more equal educational outcomes for students. And the big question is whether that can be translated into labour market outcomes and incomes in later life. But something about the mixing and the way the school system's been organised and changed in London seems to have been kind of inequality reducing in that sense. And maybe if cities are quite unequal in income terms, in the kind of the classic way we think about it, they might be better at producing equal outcomes in kind of from other perspectives, and some of that might be about the mix.
Well, you raise a great point. I mean, you know, one of our constant messages is really when we think about, you know, one of the best economic policies, many of them are early school, early education interventions because of the way that you provide young children and teenagers with the skills and attributes for them to go on, rather than think about getting them when they're, you know, they're not in the labour market post 19 and such. But Fran, your thought on that? So there does seem to be something around, you know, the demographic element, the mixing of the variety of pupils from different backgrounds and the attributes that that brings in terms of how that's improved educational performance. More starkly, I think, in London, but actually in other cities, I think there's been nowhere near as much, but there has been some effects, some improvements as well.
When you look at census data on London, and in particular focus on the indices of multiple deprivation, you do tend to find a quite striking pattern that when it comes to the education and skills category, London neighbourhoods, which are otherwise classified as relatively or multiply deprived in terms of living environments, in terms of income, in terms of health and so on, will show good education and skills outcomes, particularly when they have younger populations. So I agree that at that level, there is something to learn from the experience of the past 20 years. It may well be that the sort of sorting that we might be concerned about happens after that point. So it's how then to carry through the good work from early years into people's chances in the labour market, the housing market, and beyond. But more generally, I think the issue of education points us to one of the things that cities are good at in respect of mitigating inequalities, if not entirely preventing them. Given the density of populations in cities, there are real opportunities for collective provision, for collective consumption, for collective services that can be socialised in various ways, whether that's through the state, the local, the municipal, the metropolitan or national governments, or whether it's through forms of voluntary social organisation. The opportunity to provide all kinds of resources through larger scale collective provision and the kinds of economies of scale they produce is particularly great for cities.
Yeah.
Education, of course, is one of them. Transport is another. Open and green space is another. All of these things that can improve the quality of people's lives and their life chances can be provided more efficiently at higher quality and possibly at lower overall costs where you have densities of population. I think that's one of the key directions in which we need to look in thinking about how to address inequality.
Brilliant. So you've outlined a bunch of sort of areas of intervention or things that we can begin to think about. Many of them are certainly operating at the city level and at the urban level. Many of them are not in the control of at the urban level. They're recipients of things that are going on elsewhere. Laura, what in terms of thinking about how we might deal with the inequality that we observe in our cities, give us a sense from your perspective on the balance between, you know, what we need to think about at the national level of policy, and then how that plays through into, I suppose, the more city level thinking and sort of city level action.
Well, it's a really interesting time to be asking that question because, I mean, I think traditionally most of the policy levers have been at the national level. We have quite a centralised political system, but there's in recent years been a kind of a massive focus on devolution and in particular devolution to cities. So I'm thinking of the City Deals initiative and local enterprise partnerships, which have kind of seem to have taken off most in urban areas. So traditionally, I would say you need to kind of go to the national level to make real progress on things like housing, on things like the tax and benefit system, because that's where the decisions are made. But increasingly, cities are, central government saying to cities, look, we'll give you powers, we'll give you funding pots, but you have to come up with a plan and you have to tell us how you can do it better than we control it from Westminster. So there's a real opportunity to change things at both levels. And in terms of what you actually do, just point to a couple of things to kick us off. I think the really obvious problem with a non-obvious solution is housing. I think everybody recognises we have a housing crisis and that housing crisis plays out differently in different spaces. It's mostly a city problem. It's particularly a London problem in the UK, but not exclusively. What national government, what London and what other cities can do to tackle that is really complex. We need more supply. We probably need more public investment, but you know, kind of achieving that in approaching a spending review where we're supposed to get 20 billion of further cuts looks difficult. But there are things that local authorities and city authorities can do in terms of the use of public land and what they do in their procurement and things like that. How an organisation like Transport for London, for example, uses its land to help provide housing opportunities in London. That there are real things that can be done at the city level there. The other thing I point to is the role of wage floors. We have a national minimum wage, and now we've got a new thing called the national living wage, which isn't really a living wage as you'd classically think of it. It's actually a higher minimum wage, but the key word there is national. That's set at a level that can be borne across the country, and often cities tend to have higher wages on average, meaning that the national minimum wage has much less bite.
Indeed.
So focusing on things like the London living wage, focusing on getting businesses to take up voluntary living wages in other cities around the country, this could have a real impact on the prospects of low earners in cities.
And interestingly, more and more US cities have gone down, well, states, but and particularly cities have gone down this boost in the national minimum wage, which is obviously very low in the US compared to the UK in terms of the bite. But they've introduced places like Seattle, so it's not just some of the poorest, some of the richer cities have really begun to try and address this issue. I think to deal with this, the pushing out, the displacement of those on lower incomes that find it very difficult to live in the city and work in the city.
Yeah, and on that specific point, just I wouldn't advocate. I think we our kind of minimum wage architecture in this country is really successful, and I wouldn't advocate a kind of fragmentation of the minimum wage or the voluntary living wage by having sort of every city and every kind of area come up with their own version of it. Because I think one of the successes of that policy has been its national traction. The fact that it's understood by employers and it's understood to be the law because it's simple. But that's not to say that cities can't think about how in certain sectors where there is the ability to pay more, they can put pressure on or create kind of incentives for business to do that, potentially in public procurement. That should be used, I think, much more strongly as a vehicle to make sure that the jobs being created are good jobs, well-paid jobs for local people who need those opportunities. So I wouldn't want to see the kind of minimum and living wage movements in the UK go in the direction of the US where there's a million different numbers all over the place and nobody really knows what's going on. But there is scope for cities to do more on low pay, look at voluntary living wages, think about how the London living wage can be taken up more in London and things like that.
Yeah. Brian, you talked about earlier on about markets and the role of markets in cities. And we're trying to think about now what might we do differently to help our cities address some of the challenges and issues they've got around inequality. And you alluded to different ways of organising to deliver services or provide, you know, resources that communities and people need. More thinking on that. Do we need more thinking on that in the UK? That seems to be an emerging economy or developing country sort of perspective, which is well understood, but not really one that gets much traction in the UK. Am I wrong on that, or is that where?
I think this is an instance where actually the rich world cities are learning from the poor world cities in terms of a certain kind of social urbanism, which is trying to promote collective action, direct action, self-help, mutual aid, and so on. It's dangerous to talk about this because this kind of strategy has appeal across the political spectrum. And of course, we're currently seeing efforts from the national government, again, to engineer, as it were.
This is big society.
Voluntary organisation, exactly. So once government goes from having a kind of a supportive role to a directive role, you know, you will self-help, then we're in murky waters. Having said that, of course, I was stressing the importance of markets in cities for organising many, many different aspects of people's lives, and as the mechanism through which people access much of, you know, their needs and wants in daily life. On the other side of that, again, the very density of cities creates all these opportunities for local organisation, for extended forms of voluntary organisation. Cities support that kind of action because there are lots of us. Mm. There are lots of people with different kinds of skills, with different kinds of interests, with different kinds of commitments. So the sort of human capital potential of cities is not just about what you're doing in paid labour markets. It's also about what you're doing in trying to meet your needs and wants in the rest of your lives. And we've always got to remember, and it's easy to forget it when you live in a city like London, that most of the time we're not working in the capitalist market. We're not, you know, most of the time we're helping out friends, we're supporting our families, we're doing things which are not commodified, which aren't being priced, which aren't being marketized and calculated in those ways. And if we were to think creatively, but I think not too prescriptively, about how that works in cities everywhere, not just a kind of poor world urbanism, but a dominant way of form of everyday life in cities.
I want to come back, as we draw to a close, come back to this, the original observation about the role of cities and the way that they both drive, but also are the places where inequality manifests itself. And I suppose the first question to get your thoughts on is, you know, if we think about inequality and our desire to deal with it, to improve it or to reduce inequality, can we really do that without cities? And it's a sort of question. On the one hand, people say cities are bad. We see inequality. We need to, you know, that's they're bad things for a more equal society, a more equal economy. But we've also talked about the inherent values and attractiveness of cities as both the vehicles and the means by which people can improve their lot and all of that. And I wonder whether, when we think about inequality, we can really, can we really think seriously about how we deal with inequality without also thinking seriously about our urban areas and the role of them? I don't know. Laura, what do you think?
I think, no. I mean, I think most jobs are done in cities. People who don't live in them go to them to work. Mm. Policies are often tested out first in cities. Crises, the housing crisis, kind of debt crises and things like that tend to happen first in cities. So cities are just often the test bed and the kind of bellwether for a lot of what's going on in our kind of wider labour market and economy. And as we've discussed, I think the general thing is that they can be drivers of inequality, or they can be places where inequality is more likely to happen, but they can also be some of the places where the opportunities to move up out of low income are greatest because of the educational opportunities presented or the kind of rich access to markets and services and economies of scale that they present. So cities are a manifestation of the problem and at the heart of the solution. And coming back to the point I made about devolution, we're really relying on some of our cities. I'm thinking in particular of Manchester, which appears to be the test bed for all kind of localism. Devo Manc is a phrase I hear all too
indeed,
often.
No,
but Manchester has very strong local leadership, very active kind of think tank policy space, thinking about issues in Manchester and really leading the way. So we are relying on cities to test out our new political and economic models, and we'll continue to do so. So I think it's kind of very, very circular to say something's both the problem and the solution, but a lot of stuff happens first in cities, and we're not gonna tackle problems of inequality or kind of how we reorganise public services in a time of fiscal constraint and how we make decisions closer to where people live without cities. And we're probably going to do it first in cities, and hopefully best in a lot of cities too.
Great. Fran?
Cities are always problems and solutions at the same time, and often for the same reason.
I suppose they wax and wane in terms of whether we primarily see them as problems or solutions. I don't know.
Whether it's a good or bad day.
Yeah, it's good or bad, yeah.
But there's an analogy, I suppose, with the environmental effects of cities, that cities clearly are productive of environmental ills, and they represent great opportunities for innovative environmental solutions and economies and ecologies of scale. I think the same is true for inequalities. And I suppose from a social perspective, I want to really press the point that in respect of non-income inequalities, cities are often very good spaces for promoting a more inclusionary, a less unequal or divisive image of the social. So the kinds of unequal opportunities, unequal treatment, unequal access to public space, to public voice that revolve around gender, that revolve around race, migration status, culture, cities often have a very beneficial role to play in addressing those, in normalizing difference in these ways. Of course, these kinds of differentiations often are linked to economic inequalities, but they're not primarily economic in character. And I think cities as mixed, dense, diverse environments can be productive of forms of interaction, of mutual tolerance, of mutual regard, of political organization and mobilization that certainly have positive effects in terms of the non-income basis of unequal treatment, of unequal opportunity, of unequal experience.
I suppose get final thoughts, really, and you can pick up on the, when you look to the future, I suppose, are you optimistic or pessimistic, Laura, that, you know, will we become more equal like our European colleagues, or do you think we'll inevitably drift towards a more American, more unequal future? I mean, what's your sense as to the future for the country as a whole?
Well, I always try and start from a position of optimism. Good. But I actually think it's a really open question in terms of kind of where we go over the next few years. I think we've had kind of, if you like, this kind of real shocking long financial crash, and how we emerge from that really remains to be seen. I'd sort of highlight, I suppose, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently is how much further we have to go before we get to full employment. And when you dig down beneath the surface on that, a lot of that actually comes down to the fact that some parts of the country have very tight labour markets and there's an awful lot of slack in others.
Yes.
So kind of getting to full employment will be about picking up that slack in the less well-functioning labour markets in the country. Some of those are urban, some aren't. So that's kind of inequality between places and between different cities or between cities and rural areas. But the key thing really is actually focusing on specific groups. So I'm thinking of disabled people in the workforce, the low-skilled, single parents. And I think actually there's a massive opportunity to tackle some of those problems in cities first and best because of some of the advantages that cities have that we've talked about in terms of the scale of opportunities they create and some of the kind of social and market resources they provide. So I'm agnostic, if you like, about where we're going overall on inequality, but optimistic about the role for cities in driving more equal outcomes or better outcomes for low earners at the very least, if done right and if we can harness things like the living wage movement, things like devolution and city deals, devolution to urban areas, and translate things like better educational outcomes into better outcomes in terms of earnings and incomes.
Fran, optimistic or pessimistic? American or European?
I'm an urban optimist by nature and by disposition, but I'm pessimistic, actually. I think we're going in the wrong direction, and it's possibly not because of the actions of cities and city governments, but the impact of national level policies in housing and tax and benefits are going to be very negative for many urban residents and for people more generally across the country. And it's reflective of a certain kind of political shift. It's not simply a set of policy measures. It's a larger political shift, which I think is anti-urban, and we've always had a problem with anti-urbanism in this country. Cities as an evil, cities as a problem, cities as not really the place where most of us would want to be if we could choose freely. One of the reasons why inequality has always been a concern for urban critics has been because cities tend to concentrate large numbers of poor people, and they still do. But at the moment, one of the main drivers of inequality in our cities is the concentration of the very rich in many cities. We see it throughout the United States, where income inequalities are growing across basically all metropolitan regions in that country, and we also see it in the UK and in London in particular. So there's, as well as, of course, being concerned in political and policy terms about those who are worse off, we've also got to think about quite how we manage in cities with the people who are really, really exceptionally well off, and quite what that does for and to our cities.
My guests today have been Laura Gardner and Fran Tonkis. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.